You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when you buy a product, a phone, a computer printer, a car, a coffee maker, piece of farm equipment, do you own it? Easy question, right? Of course you own it. You bought it. But our next guest says, wait, not so easy. If you crack the screen on the phone, can you repair it yourself or take it to any shop? Some manufacturers might stop certain features on your phone if you do. Same goes for expensive combines and tractors on farms. And more manufacturers are creating subscription fees to use features on your product. Some car companies, for example, have fees to use your seat warmer or enhanced acceleration features, again, on the car you bought. Printers get mad at you if you try to use third-party ink cartridges. Our next guest says we're seeing ownership rights chipped away, but we can do something about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into this? Have you tried to repair something or get something repaired, but found out that you could void a warranty or even end up with an unusable product? Have you bought something and then had to pay a regular fee to keep using some features on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nathan Proctor is Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. Nathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I've heard about the repair issues, and we'll talk about the right to repair concept in a bit. But this new piece you wrote, we've got it linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Something a little different here. How are companies finding ways to get people to keep paying to use features of products they already bought?
Yeah, it's something that is kind of at the heart of the Right to Repair campaign is this premise that you bought it, you own it, you should be able to use it however you want. But because the products that we use now are dependent on software and the internet, there's just all kinds of opportunities for the manufacturer to code them in such a way or to control them through the internet in such a way where they get to tell you what to do with the product. And a lot of times they're using that control to get you to buy more things from the company, more services, you know, upgrades. I mean, people know the printer ink, for example, you know, that if you want to get the printer ink that's made by the company, it's a lot more expensive than the alternatives. But the alternatives, it's very difficult to get them to work. And that's because of the software restrictions that are put inside the printer that just make it hard for the you know, aftermarket companies to supply compatible cartridges. And this is happening. It's going to happen more and more, especially with the internet, because that gives companies the ability to you know, change the terms of use remotely to try to continually, you know, hassle you to get you to buy more stuff from them. And that's wrong.
I shared one of the examples from the piece you wrote. I had not heard of this. A couple of car companies are saying, yeah, your car comes with a seat warmer. And if you subscribe and pay money, you can use the seat warmer and some other features. What is going on in cars?
Well, I mean, the companies that make these cars are being basically pushed to find ways to get more monthly revenue out of the car. And it doesn't matter if it's fair or reasonable in some of these examples. It's just technologically possible. It's actually technologically trivial, right? But it's extractive and wrong. Like that same example, I mean, the first time I heard of that, I was like, well, why wouldn't you just bypass the internet and put a switch there? I mean, the seat heater is physically in the car. It's not difficult to turn something on and off. You don't need an internet connection for that feature. It'd be like if that person who made you, a contractor who built your house, charged you monthly subscription fees so that the light switches worked. I mean, we wouldn't accept that because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't accept it in our cars either.
There's just a few examples in your piece. If I'm reading you right, your concern is this is just the early wave, and we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing potentially in consumer products.
Yeah, I was talking with you know, a friend of mine at a child's birthday party, and he said that, you know, in his line of work, there's just these Wall Street guys, he said, come in and they just try to push you to find whatever way you can to find some way to force people to pay monthly for things. And there's so much pressure because there's so much profit margin in that kind of business operation that they're just going to even if it doesn't make any sense, even if it drives customers crazy, there's just so much money to be made that unless we set up rules to say you're not allowed to do this, it's just going to happen more and more with more different products.
Talking to Nathan Proctor with US PERG. He heads the campaign for the right to repair there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these ways that companies try to get you to pay for stuff monthly that you already bought from them, and the right to repair and how difficult it can be to repair things yourself or to go to a repair shop, unless it's the manufacturer's repair shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ryan is with us in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
I just want to say, as somebody who's kind of been the family IT repair guy, who's been working on fixing cracked screens since Samsung Galaxy S1, that I find this whole right to repair thing absolutely critical to fighting the, you know, subscription-based model that we seem to be moving for absolutely everything. If we want to talk about vehicles, let's talk about John Deere and how they're affecting the farming equipment that's being used by farmers in our region. If we want to talk about consumer products, we can talk about Apple and their continued fight to not include USB-C standardization in the EU, even though it's been passed by law. I feel like if somebody like me, who knows how to repair things and has, you know, the will to learn how to do so, because I don't have a degree in IT or anything like that, but I can, you know, put a couple screws together and I can remove some glue, I should be able to do that for something that I already paid for, and I shouldn't be stuck behind some kind of firmware wall when it comes to some sort of software keeping me from using my device exactly how I want to. And if anybody wants to look up more of this right to repair stuff in a digestible way, please look up Lewis Rossman on YouTube. I've been following him for years now, and it's just a great resource in terms of trying to figure out what this thing is all about and how important it is to us as consumers in a capitalist society that says we should be able to own things. No, maybe not so much.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Nathan, Ryan, pretty fired up there. Clearly, a couple things he brought up. First of all, he's been replacing screens on his family's phones of various makes and models for years. You write that there was at least for a while an effort to say, yeah, if you start doing that, we're going to start cutting some of your functionality. What did we see there?
Yeah, so in when the iPhone 13 first came out, if you replace the screen, you know, the front-facing camera, which handles the Face ID, is connected to the screen. And if you had it repaired outside of Apple's control, basically without Apple software, it would deactivate Face ID. It would become inoperable. And so eventually Apple pushed out a firmware update that would made it possible for aftermarket, you know, shops to repair the screen. And now it just gives you a warning that, you know, ooh, this was done by somebody who was non-genuine or whatever. And I agree with the caller 100%. And you can just hear how frustrated and annoying it is to be told that you can't do something just because you're not blessed by the manufacturer. I think it's fundamentally un-American. Like, we're a nation of tinkerers and makers. Like, we're not just consumers, like, we're producers. So many of the innovations that make our lives great are things that, you know, people came up with tinkering in their garage, including these companies that are now telling us we're not smart enough to touch our own products. Like, they started in garages. And I think that they need to extend the same kind of collaborative, you know, cooperative hand to us that made their technology possible.
Ryan also brought up a key issue here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, very expensive farm equipment with proprietary software, unique tools that you might only be able to get at a manufacturer-approved shop. What are we seeing there, Nathan?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would say that for both, you know, these consumer products and farm equipment, we've now won state laws which mandate that the companies like Apple and John Deere have to share the materials that they use in their authorized repair shops with independent mechanics and technicians and product owners. But farm equipment is a huge, you know, leading issue on right to repair, in part because farmers are completely dependent on functional working equipment to make a living and to stay in business and to keep their farm. And when the only way to get something fixed because of a an intentional technological lock on the equipment that makes it so you have to use certain software tools to get it working again, and the dealer is the only one in possession of those tools, like that creates a huge problem for farmers. The biggest problem there is the downtime. If the equipment's not working and you need to get the seed in the ground or get the fertilizer down or harvest the crop before a big storm, you're not going to want to be told by the equipment dealer, oh, we can't come out today, or we can't come out till 3 weeks from now. One example from Oklahoma in a recent report that we put out out to pasture said that the dealer told me it was going to be 9 months before they could calibrate the hydraulic equipment on his equipment so that it would go back into service. 9 months, that's an entire season. That's ridiculous.
Thanks again for that call, Ryan. We're talking to Nathan Proctor from US PERG about a recent piece he wrote on the death of ownership and the ways companies get us to keep paying for things we already bought and make it hard to get our stuff repaired unless we go to the company that made it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's gotten more difficult to repair stuff? Electronics, appliances, tractors, you name it. Do you have a product where you have to use something proprietary made by that company, printer cartridges, coffee refills, you name it, just to use the product you bought? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG, the Public Interest Research Group, looking at the way companies make it harder for us to get consumer products repaired and new technologies that make us keep paying to use features on things we already bought, from phones and farm equipment, coffee makers to cars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan, before we go back to our callers, you mentioned some states are passing laws, including just very recently, our neighbors in Minnesota. What did we see there?
Yeah, Minnesota passed the broadest right to repair law we've seen. It mandates that manufacturers of a lot of products, although unfortunately not including farm equipment, have to share all the parts, tools, and information that they make available for their own authorized networks to fix things to the product owner and to independent shops. So starting in July of next year, it's going to be a lot easier to fix products in Minnesota, everything from, dishwashers and cell phones to, enterprise computing equipment and HVAC and a whole set of other products. And I think it's going to save people a lot of money. And it's going to cut electronic waste. And that's a really, really big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Marquesan. Rob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Rob?
Microsoft. Recently, they did a deal where they did an update. And basically, all of the Office application on my computer disappeared. And finally got a hold of them on it. And took 3 weeks before they finally gave me a copy of it back, which was a different copy than what I had. So my product key didn't work. I had to spend another week to get the right flavor. But yeah, they did it as part of an update and it just disappeared. And it took almost a month to prove that I paid for it and that they should give it back.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Nathan, whether it's a computer or anything else that uses software, that software update, that's a chance for companies to do stuff that consumers like Rob aren't going to be too happy about.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I mean, one of the things that happens pretty frequently is a loss of features with an update. And that can be really upsetting. and you wonder if some of these updates are really to improve the security or the device operation or to accomplish something else. And I think, I mean, from a cybersecurity perspective, it's really scary when companies put, kind of other anti-consumer updates in those update files, because we really want people to update everything to the most latest version to patch vulnerabilities that help protect the internet against cybercrime. But people are resistant to doing that because they've had these experiences where they've lost key functionality because an update had some other change in it. And I think that that's definitely something that companies need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Bridget joins us now in Superior. Bridget, hi.
Hi. I had a situation with an air conditioner, and I called the thermal guy who put it in, and he came out and took some parts apart and left it undone. I asked him to come and put it back together. He didn't. And I kept calling about the part. Got to the point where he wouldn't return my calls. Went on, I called different companies. And by the time the next company came, left it exposed, mice had chewed it. So, yeah, so then it wasn't, then they wouldn't cover the warranty and he wouldn't return my calls.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Nathan, I don't know if this is exactly a right-to-repair issue, but the idea that if there's only one game in town, only the manufacturer can repair it, if that was the case in Bridget's, I don't think that probably was here, you'd have no recourse. The idea that, okay, there might be multiple places you can go to get something repaired gives us a better chance that we're going to find somebody who can do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, your likelihood of getting a good experience with a service technician is really enhanced by competition, kind of weeding the market of people who treat customers like this story we just heard. Like, hopefully we can, the market will squeeze those people out. And so that companies that treat their customers well and charge them a fair rate are the only ones around.
Bridget, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Racine. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment or at least ask for some commentary on the transition to software as a service or computing as a service overall in that We're actually losing access to our computing devices and the software on them in a push for greater revenue and, more pervasive and perpetual licensing of software. You used to be able to buy Microsoft Office one time and use it for a decade, and now Microsoft wants us to buy a perpetual license every year. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as it relates to
it. Interesting, Aaron. Thanks for that. Interesting question. Nathan, what do you think? We used to buy a box of software, install it ourselves, and own it as long as we had that computer. Now it's a service, Aaron says.
Yeah, I mean, this is the blessing and the curse of the internet, right? Where software is not a static application anymore, right? Because, a Nintendo cartridge pretty much plays the same now as it did, back in 1986. But the other games that we're playing are all dependent on the internet. And that just completely changes what we're buying when we buy software. I think that this is a big question. And I think that there, as I argue in the piece that you're referencing, The Death of Ownership, at least there's truth in advertisement when Microsoft says what you're paying for is the continual monitoring and updating of this and you pay monthly. At least you know what you're getting. It's obviously different if they sell you something and you think you bought it outright, but really you just bought the first, entry and now you have to pay monthly to actually use it. So they're separate issues, but I look forward to a world where there's just a lot more transparency, clarity, and options for people to have more control over the technology in our lives. And one of the problems we have in an overly consolidated tech market is, if people would rather just pay once and have something static and lasted exactly the way they bought it, maybe they would. But with so few options in the tech market, there's just not an incentive to create those products because everybody's looking for, these monthly revenue streams. And so they're just going to push us into these systems, whether or not we actually want them.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And Nathan, talking about transparency, somebody might think, okay, well, I won't buy a product that's going to have this hidden monthly charge to use all of its functions. Is it always that easy to tell when we're buying something that that's going to happen?
I mean, the reason why, like, we have this thing in the Uniform Commercial Code and state laws that it that protects consumers from unfair and deceptive practices is because you shouldn't have to walk around the Best Buy and think, which of these products is not being marketed to me deceptively to trick me into paying for some monthly thing that I don't know about. Like, we just should not have, you know, you shouldn't walk around the grocery store. Yeah, maybe some of these products that say they're potato chips are really like rat poison. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There should be just standard consumer protection that the products that are being sold are safe and usable. And I think that that's what I'm advocating for, right? If you're going to tether somebody to a secret software arrangement where you get to extract a monthly payment from them, you know, that needs to be exposed and there needs to be transparency there. And people are being, you know, kind of duped by these companies and they find themselves totally dependent on their system, which now all of a sudden is way more expensive than they thought at the outset. And I think that, you know, we should the system should protect consumers from that kind of deceptive product.
Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Proctor with the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG. The piece we've been talking about called The Death of Ownership, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, disabilities and aging don't have to kick us out of the kitchen. It's Food Friday. We'll get advice on cooking for everybody with the author of the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. This is Central Time. Does it sometimes feel like your family or maybe your close group of friends speaks its own language? If so, you're not alone. What you're speaking is called a familect. That's a unique set of words or phrases created and used within a tight-knit social group. These private languages, these family dialects, can tell us a lot about their speakers and their relationships with one another. The term familect was originally coined for multilingual families, but the term has since evolved. Now it could apply to the unique language of any close social unit. A topic of interest to word nerds like maybe you and certainly our next guest. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, do you have some of these words and phrases that are unique maybe in your family or maybe your group of friends or a workplace? How did that word or those phrases come about? What's the story behind it? Was it the result of a mispronunciation, a funny circumstance, a strange interaction? Call in now with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Martha Barnett is a co-host of Away with Words, a public radio show about language. You can hear the show on the Ideas Network on Sunday mornings at 9. She's the author of several books on word origins. Martha, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what a familect, apart from being hard to say, a familect actually is?
Yeah, you have it right. A familect is like a dialect. A dialect is a regional variety of language that's distinguished by its vocabulary, pronunciation, and grammar. And a familect is that same kind of thing, only much smaller. It's a private slang. It's that unique vocabulary of words and phrases, and sometimes different pronunciations that belong to a family or, as you said, a close-knit social group. And what makes them so much fun, in part, is that they're often completely unintelligible to somebody outside your family. And that's one of the things that's really great about these familects is it's all about connection. They help us feel like family. It gives us a sense of intimacy. You know, it's like any kind of slang that's shared by a group reinforces the idea that, hey, we all belong to each other. We understand each other. We have a history. And, you know, sometimes these words and phrases will stick with us for life. They're so special and so uniquely identified with dad or grandma that sometimes that word or phrase is going to end up in that person's obituary. We see that a lot.
And you have a great data set among Away with Words listeners. Do you hear a lot of these examples of unique words and phrases from families?
Oh my gosh, all the time. It's so much fun. A lot of times they arise spontaneously. It's what a linguist referred to as the effervescing of language. Like from childhood misunderstandings or mispronunciations. Maybe your toddler couldn't say the word phone, and to this day, everybody in the household says, "Hey, hand me my phone," you know. or my little brother couldn't pronounce my name Martha, and so for years and years and years after he was, you know, a public speaker, I was still Mimi in the family. Or, you know, little kids will come up with, you know, Barsh barrels for marshmallows, or hiccup truck. We heard that one from a listener. And sometimes, you know, even within a couple, you'll have your own language. You know, you'll be on your own planet linguistically, and maybe you were texting back and forth and autocorrect changed your message to something hilarious, and you just keep using that word.
One of my favorites in my family is when our kids were littler, we went to this park a little further away. It had a seesaw shaped like a hot dog. So, of course, we called it Hot Dog Seesaw Park. Well, the seesaw broke. They took it out. And we still call it Hot Dog Seesaw Park years later. And it would have absolutely no meaning to anyone, even if they played in that park every day.
Yeah, that's a great one.
We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way with Words about family dialects, familects, those unique words and phrases that can happen within a family or maybe a other tight social group. And we're hoping to hear some of your examples at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginny is with us now in Lancaster. Ginny, hello.
Hello.
You've got an example for us?
Hi, Ginny.
Yes. So in the mid to late 70s, I played on the women's basketball team at the UW. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, this word was developed, and we would say it meant like you're not doing anything. You're just being. And so like the word was cartonite. So if somebody asked you what you were doing, you'd say, "I'm cartonizing." Or you're engaging in cartonization. I mean, it was just this random thing that we developed as a team. I guess it was a team luck kind of thing. Maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Ginny, I want to ask, is this something that happened off the court, or could you say something was cartonizing on the court? Like, yeah, you're out there, but you're not defending, you know, your assignment or whatever. You're cartonizing on the court.
I think we mainly tried to do it off the court.
Well, I hope
so. We wouldn't get in trouble. Yeah.
Ginny, thanks so much. I would bet sports teams are, you know, you're with these people a lot in very intense situations,
right?
Martha. That seems like a perfect environment for some of these word inventions.
Boy, it sure does. Yeah, any small close-knit group like that is going to develop their own shorthand, and it's much more efficient that way, but it can be so much fun. I mean, I'll bet that when she texts with her ex-teammates now, you know, they can still use that word and everybody knows what it means. It's sort of like this wonderful verbal photo album.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ginny, at 800-642-1234. Well, I hope the Central Time team doesn't accuse me of cartonizing through the day now. Marcus is with us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So when my grandma was alive, she used to say that you really only needed three movies to understand life. That was White Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life, and The Godfather. And so she used to quote to us pretty heavily out of those three movies. But two that stuck around is from White Christmas. Let's just say we're doing it for a pal in the army, you know, which is sometimes let's just say it's for a pal in the army or just a pal. You know, it's like a tenuous connection where you're kind of obligated and you should do this, but you really don't want to. And so that's when he's pointing to his fake arm and rubbing it. And then the other one from White Christmas that she used a lot and we still continue to use is snood. Meaning like a stash or a hoard of, you know, like if we were keeping chips in our room as children or as teenagers and we had them in Tupperware, all of a sudden we come down and we're eating Sun Chips. And my dad might look at us and be like, "Where'd you just pull those out of your snood?" And it's like, you know, it's a reserve that you probably shouldn't have, or you should be more sharing with the rest of the family.
Okay, Marcus, I got to ask, one of those movies is an odd one out. Where did The Godfather come into it? Did grandma make you an offer you can't refuse? Like, you're going to eat dinner, or did you have to keep your friends close, your enemies closer? Where did that fit in?
Rob, I don't want to have to come with a signed check and Luca Brasi. That's all I got to say.
All right. Marcus, thank you so much. Now, this is another category, Martha. In a band I've been in for a long many years, we could exist solely, I think, on certain movie references. Does this end up being part of our shared tight-knit language?
Oh, sure. You know, a family sits around watching TV night after night, and you just pick up different words and phrases. The one that's going around in our house is "off you pup," which we'd never heard until we started watching the British baking show. And, you know, when they send the judges away for a little bit, they say "off you pup." And now we just say that. And I think we're going to be using that for quite a while.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that story. We're talking to Martha Barnett, co-host of A Way with Words. We're looking at familects, family dialects, the unique made-up languages or words and phrases that we share with our families or our basketball team or other tight-knit group of friends and colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these? Do you have many of these? Maybe one with your family, one with your coworkers, one with I don't know who. Love to hear some of your great examples and where they came from at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about familects, the unique words and phrases we share with our families or other close relationships. Martha Barnett is with us, co-host of the radio show A Way with Words. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your unique words in your family? You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call 800-642-1234. Amanda is with us now in Watertown. Hi there, Amanda.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what is your word for us?
I've actually got two. They're words that my daughter couldn't say when she was growing up. She couldn't say "you're welcome." She always said "whack'em." And so we would say "whack'em, whack'em," and that went well into her teens. And we would try to teach her to call our cats to her. So we'd say, "come here." We do the kissy sound, and she'd go, "meer." And she, again, it's one of those things that has just stuck with us. I mean, we just went and visited her a couple weeks ago in college, and we did it again, and always has the motions and the whole sound effects and everything.
All right, let's try it. Amanda, thank you for calling.
Whack'em, whack'em.
Also awesome. Thank you, Amanda, for that. Now, Martha, we had some of those, the kids couldn't pronounce a potty, so pot it was the word for a bathroom for a long time. Is this a pretty common, that kid mispronunciation, pretty common source of these familect words?
Calls about those all the time. And they're just, you know, they're just so precious. It's just a little picture of your child when they were very small. And as Amanda said, these things stick around for a lifetime often. And, you know, she mentioned cats, and I was thinking that another example of this kind of thing is the names of our pets. They often evolve. You know, you give the pet a name like we heard from a listener who first called their pet, their cat, Orange Juice. And then eventually the cat's name was Lanny because it went from Orange Juice to Juice to Foose to Poos to Pusillanimous to Lanny Mouse. And then to Lanny. And these are things that the family shared and nobody else did. And that's what's so precious about it.
I wonder if the cat was cool with all of that. I don't know. Hard to tell, though.
And if there's food involved, I think they'd be okay.
Yeah. Do we see that kind of evolution in the words within a family very often? Because I think I can think of examples like that in my own family where it started as one thing. And then 3 years later, it's been through 20 steps and it's something completely different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's often the case.
Thanks for your call, Amanda. Mark joins us now in Menominee. Mark, what did you want to share with us?
So when my oldest son was really young, he super loved Pringles, but he would only leave like one or two chips in the bottom of it. And so the phrase "you Pringled that" came about. And so now whenever there's anything with like one or two things left, even today's dude, who Pringled the cheese? Who Pringled the chip?
I am totally stealing that. That is fantastic.
Yeah, Mark.
I'm guilty of that as well, Mark.
And you keep saying it now, Mark. Is this something you've said in front of other people, not family members, and they kind of do a double take?
We get all kinds of weird looks. It happens, you know, at the restaurant. It happens at other people's houses. Yeah, of course.
Thanks a lot. That is a great one, Mark. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martha, I mean, do we think it happens sometimes that that word might start at the family or local group level, but somehow goes viral, even maybe before the internet, and starts to spread into the language?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, expressions like FHB, I don't know if your family ever used that. I think early on that was pretty localized for family hold back. You know, if you have guests over and you want to kind of give a subtle message to everybody around the table that they shouldn't take food so that the guests can have enough.
FHB.
FHB or FLO, flow, family layoff. They're little things that family members can say to each other and other people don't get it. You know, sort of like that look when you're invited to somebody's house and maybe you do something to catch your partner's eye and tell him you want to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jean is with us now in Madison. Jean, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about boogeyman names.
Oh.
Now, do you have unique ones in your family, Jean?
Well, I grew up outside of Fond du Lac in a neighborhood where we sort of ran wild in the 60s and 70s, and we had a boogeyman named Butchum Birium Beer.
And I did you make that name up?
Well, I don't know. I was kind of the youngest of the group, so I thought, do other people call the boogeyman that? But I've never seen it written. So it's
weird.
One of those, So, it was fun, but I still think about him.
Interesting. I'm a little scared now. Gene, thanks for calling in. I never thought about that, Martha. Do different parts of the country or maybe even different families have their own versions of the boogeyman or boogeymen?
Oh, there are so many boogeyman words. I mean, I'm thinking in the South, sometimes there's a reference to the Willipus Wallopus, which is this multi-legged creature that will come and get the bad children. Or Snollygoster is another one that haunts, the countryside looking for children who have misbehaved. Parents have been coming up with those words for a long time, and sometimes they're widespread, but I could see, a mom or dad coming up with a word themselves to keep those kids in line.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at those words and phrases unique to maybe one family or one group of close friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us now in Appleton. Sharon, what do you have for us?
Hi there. I have a contraction mess up that my boys did when they were little. 18 months apart, they kind of learned to talk together. And when they were saying, I am not, instead of saying, I'm not, they'd say, I am'n't. No, I am'n't. And it was just their way of saying it. They're teenagers now, and it still slips out.
Fantastic,
no,
Sharon.
No, I am't.
I am't. And Martha, I love this one because it, by the rules of contractions, it should work, right? Are not, aren't, am not, why not am't?
Right. And I think you will find that in some dictionaries, am't.
Thanks. And of course, I mean, the way that the English language has solved it informally is to go with ain't, Martha. Somebody started that at one point, right?
Yes. That ain't has been around for a very, very long time, and it doesn't bother me at all. I'm thinking this reminds me also of we've had several calls from parents whose kids are told to behave, and the kids will say, I am being have. they're misunderstanding the word, and I just love those misunderstandings that end up being things that last forever in a family.
Sharon, thanks for calling. I am it. Sorry that you called. Kay joins us next in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, two things. We had a dog that we called Skippy, because he was like peanut butter colored. And my sister broke her arm several times, and so she always had casts on her arms. And she also had smelly feet, and we would just tell her that it was Mr. Stinky or Mr. Smell.
Okay.
were what her body was smelling like.
Oh, no. How did she feel about that, Kay?
Well, I was older, so I thought that was a good thing. They didn't call me that. We okay. called it to her.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. And Martha, I'm guessing hopefully a good-natured ribbing among siblings can lead to words and phrases that catch on within a family.
Sure. That one sounds, you know, sometimes people do go by the name, especially in certain parts of the country, people will go by a name like Stinky for a long time.
I don't aspire to that. Kay, thanks a lot for the call. Jill is with us now in Rice Lake. Jill, hi.
Hi. Hold on. I have two things. My oldest son, when he was little, could not say these things, and he said them so cute that we still use it today. And one is grinkle, grinkle, little doll.
Instead of twinkle, twinkle, right?
I think we got that yes. one, yeah.
Yeah, and Ecrebity Hulk.
Ecrebity, like Incredible Hulk. Oh, okay, so that's kind of like the spaghetti paschetti sort of thing. But Jill, you say you've kept singing, what is it, Grinkle Grinkle over the years?
Grinkle Grinkle Little Doll is the way we've taught it to grandchildren. And Ecrebity Hulk, that's just who he is. You know?
Excellent, Jill. Oh, so that's another one in our category of mispronunciations that become the accepted pronunciation, Martha.
Yeah, and you know, this is reminding me of an email that we got years ago from a listener who and I would suggest this for your listeners. She compiled a 33-page document of all of these family sayings and words when the kids were growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And it's just this thing that the whole family treasures now. You know, one of the kids misunderstood New Mexico as new mixing bowls. So they would talk about wanting to go to New Mixing Bowl, or they referred to the newscaster, Walter Cronkite, as Waffle Cornflake. And these things, you know, or a post-it note as a Peely Deely. And again, it's like a family photo album. It's a really, I think, great exercise.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, what's your example?
Hi. When my daughter was, I don't know, about five, we were playing school. She was the teacher. I was the student. I did a picture or something for her. And then a little while later, she said, Mama, how do you make, what letter makes the J sound? And I said, well, it could be a G or a J. What are you doing? No, nothing. And then she handed me my picture back with a grade on the top. And it said, good gob.
And did you stick with that, good Susie?
God.
Good gob?
Well, we still say it. And she's like a lead nurse in Milwaukee Hospital now. And she occasionally will commend her other nurses when they do something quality. Good gob.
Oh.
I had to explain to them what it was. Because they thought, what? You know.
Oh, that's a great example, Susie. Thank you so much. Martha, just a few moments left. You collect these kind of things at Away With Words, right? People can go to your website and share their unique words with you?
Absolutely. Yeah, waywardradio.org. You can mail it to us at words@waywardradio.org. We'd love to hear more about these. The list goes on and on. I don't think we've Pringled this yet.
Oh, you did a good job today, Martha. Thanks for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
It's Martha Barnett, co-host of A Way with Words. You can hear that here on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. You can keep sharing your unique words and phrases you share with your family and close friends on the Ideas Network Facebook page.